You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head to New Jersey today in the company of Mike Vermant, the producer of the video series In the Shadow of Big Red Eye. Mike's interest in the Bigfoot field started after some unusual incidents on a field trip organised by the Finding Bigfoot team in Florida back in 2011. And after relocating to New Jersey, he thought his Bigfooting days could be over. Yet, New Jersey is a state with a long history of hairy hominids, and Mike discusses his investigations, expeditions, and some of his plans for further trips across the USA on the hunt for Bigfoot. We touch on incidents, witnesses, strange creatures, and have a brief journey into the world of a strange mantis creature. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, and bonus content. You can also click the link on the show notes. Mysteries and Monsters is also on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find episodes, news, and more on mysteriesandmonsters.com. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. The Garden State now awaits us, and perhaps not everything is as green and pleasant as what it may first seem. Today we head off into the North American wilderness on the hunt for Bigfoot in the company of Mike Vermant. Mike's interest began after an incident back in 2011 whilst on an expedition in North Florida. Since 2016, he's created his own show called In the Shadow of Big Red Eye, which is now approaching its sixth season, and his passion to share his love is obvious to all, encouraging others to get out into nature and appreciate everything it has to offer. Mike, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
What a great introduction. Thank you for having me. That was perfect. Great.
Oh, that's easy then. You'll be like, put you in my hands, Mike, now then, after that introduction, my friend. Mike, I'm always interested to finally get a chance to speak with people whose careers I've been aware of and content that I've seen for quite a while. And you're one of those people that I've always been very impressed with, because often in the world of Bigfoot, and I'm sure you've stumbled across this over the last 10 or 15 years, lots of people tend to over-egg their experiences or try and create content that tends to be falling into one particular category. But I've always been very impressed with the fact that you keep it very simple, it's boots on the ground, and you never seem to make any kind of wild characterizations or claims.
And that's what I think separates my show from, and that's kind of why I made the show. You know, obviously, like you said, my main goal is to get you know, friends and families outside and off the couch and into nature. But the second reason why I made the show is because all the shows on TV do kind of portray Bigfooting as this kind of mystical kind of thing that you do. And you come across evidence every single time. And, you know, that's not really how it works, unfortunately. As much as we would love that to happen, that's not how it is.
As with anything, when we discuss the paranormal, or hauntings or Bigfooting, the TV version is often very, very different to the reality, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I wanted to show viewers, is that, you know, there's a lot more to Bigfooting besides just going out and doing vocalizations and hoping that you get a reply. You know, there's a lot of behind the scenes things, I guess, if you will, that I show that the other people don't. You know, we go around to these local towns and we film in these small little, you know, local towns and stuff like that. We interview people and it's just, I don't know, the feedback I've gotten from it is pretty positive so far, and it has been. So I'm going to continue to keep doing it.
Mm. Is it surprising looking back? Because I've often been struck when I've heard you speak about how this all started for you, that you were one of those people who wasn't really into Bigfoot, and you were just kind of sofa surfing, flicking through the channels, and stumbled across finding Bigfoot. And that seemed to be kind of the catalyst that got you into it, that you just fancied seeing what it was all about and seeing what was going on. And I think it's quite funny when you describe that first expedition, because weren't there something like 60 people on this trip?
Something crazy like that. Yeah, it was insane.
So what was it that appealed to you that very first time? Because often, you know, not everybody's as strange as I am, Mike, that I've been obsessed with this for quite a long time, despite living in the UK. It's something that I've been really interested in for probably the best part 40 years. So what hooked you that night when you just caught that show on the TV?
Well, you know, I was working at a beach resort in Florida, and it was the best job I've ever had. And I was engaged at the time, and I was like, well, they said on the show, if you want to come out with us, go on our website and you could, you know, come out and whatever. And I was like, man, that would be the coolest thing for me and my fiance to do before our wedding. I've never been camping. She's really never been camping before. That would be so cool to get out and do something completely and totally different and strange, and just to try something new before we get hitched up and whatever. And yeah, we broke up before the trip, so I don't know if that was because of the whole Bigfoot thing or not, but
you never know.
But yeah, it was just, I think it was just a kind of spur of the moment. Let me see what this is all about and let's give it a shot. And I'm glad we did. I'm glad it ended up happening the way it did. And you know, we did have some activity that last night on the trip, which kind of brought me to where we are today.
I mean, obviously this trip was down in Florida, if I'm correct, Mike. And so for a lot of people who may know a bit about Bigfoot, sometimes people are still very surprised when we talk about certain states having these encounters, because there is a lot of, I don't know, misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge in regards to the wider picture, that there are states all across the US where we've got differing versions or types or real bodies of evidence where there's been a long history of people encountering them. And Florida, along with probably Georgia and Texas, especially in the South, are probably three states that, unless you've kind of gone past the average person's interest in it, they're often surprised. And obviously most people would associate Florida with the skunk ape more than anything these days.
Sure. You know, just kind of piggybacking off of that, when I tell people that there's more than one Bigfoot in the world, that mystifies some people, you know, and that's just from looking inside, that they've never thought too much about, you know, a population. You have to have a breeding population and whatnot. But I think that's kind of funny that not only are states overlooked, but the whole concept of Bigfoot could be misconstrued because people just don't understand or have the right knowledge base, I guess, if you will. But the skunk ape is definitely a cool creature. Lives down in like you said, in Georgia and Florida, and it's kind of like a smaller version of the Bigfoot up that we have up here in the northern United States, which is like the 8 foot tall, kind of burly, muscular Bigfoot. This contrary, the skunk ape is a little bit smaller, 6 foot tall, kind of lanky, not as muscular, and smells bad. So that's how the actually fun fact for you, the skunk ape actually got its name not because of the smell, but because one of the first reports of a Florida Bigfoot was it had a white stripe down the back of the Bigfoot that resembled a skunk.
Mm.
So that's where the name skunk ape came from.
It is strange how people do now associate, because it is supposed to have quite a pungent odor to it. So people presume that that's where it came from. But yeah, it's one of those really early sightings where some of these early sightings of certain hairy bipeds across the US, some of them are quite unusual, and they have some wonderful names all across the states for some of them. I'm a big fan of any area that calls their local hairy creature a booger, for example.
Oh, yeah, the booger. Yeah. Yeah. Bird and booger, we got a couple of them. Yeah. Well, I think it's cool too, because every region of the United States has a, like you said, has a different, we have like the Ohio has the grass man, and my show In the Shadow of Big Red Eye, Big Red Eye is Sussex County, New Jersey's Bigfoot.
Mm.
So that's where we got our name from. And like I said, the skunk ape down in Florida. But it's cool because, like, I don't think people think that the northern Bigfoot and the skunk ape are two, like, completely different species, right?
Mm.
But I don't think that they are. I think that they're actually one species. And I think that could be explained by, like, it's called Bergman's rule, which means that, like, animals in southern climates and warmer climates, they don't have to eat as much through the summer to be able to sustain themselves through the winter. Mm. So they could just eat all year round. So they're generally smaller than animals up in the northern where it's colder, which means that they have to eat as much as they can throughout the warmer months because they don't have any substance storing during the winter. So that means that they're generally larger. And you could see this in like bear populations, like a 300-pound black bear in New Jersey, where I am, is like, I wouldn't bat an eye at it. But if you have a 300-pound black bear in Florida, you're calling in like the National Guard type of thing.
Yes. So. Well, nothing, to be fair, finding something like that in Florida would not surprise me. Without it, the things that are lurking outside in that particular state. So when you had this experience on this particular first trip, are you surprised looking back? I think was it 2011, I think you went on this trip, yeah. Somewhere around there, Mike, that you've gone from having a passing interest in it and trying that first trip and having this very odd incident that occurred that night to now being in a position where you've got a team, you're going out all over the place, you've visited numerous states, you're now located up in New Jersey. So do you think it was because of what occurred that night that just fired you up and thought, there's something really strange going on here and I really want to get to the bottom of it if I can?
You know, that's you took the words out of my mouth when I explained to people why I do what I do. And it's because that night was something threw rocks at me. And something did a tree knock and threw rocks at me and then threw a boulder at me. And I know this. I know that's a fact. I was with somebody. I'm not going crazy. And it's either a person or a Bigfoot. And I want to know, I don't think it was a person because it was outside of human range for somebody to throw a boulder. I don't think that's really a person could do that. So I want to know what threw rocks at me in that woods that night. And that's kind of my goal of the show. And a lot of people ask me, what are you going to do when you find one? And I don't know, because that's going to kind of complete my goal, if you will, my mission. But I don't know if I'm going to dive into it even more or just be like, oh, I'm good, and then go back to playing video games my whole life. I don't know.
Well, I think there is often that question that's never really answered, is it, for a lot of us that are really interested in this, is that for some people, they would say that it's the search or the quest, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is what keeps them moving and motivated and desperate to try and keep getting out there. But I don't think we deal with that aspect of it that much, to be honest, that, well, what are we going to do if we do find it and prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt? Because obviously there will be people out there who are very convinced, regardless of the body of evidence that we've built up over the years from all over the states, from footprints to fleeting glimpses on film to people finding structures to all kinds of things, vocalizations. And yet, for many of us, we know that real science, as they would like it to be separated by, will not accept anything until we've actually got a body or evidence that simply cannot be dismissed anymore.
What's cool is actually the scientific community, and this is a brand new thing, and I just heard Dr. Meldrum speak about it. They're introducing, the scientific community is actually is going to start allowing DNA as proof of the as existence of a species, which is really cool. And they're doing that because of all the marine life that they're finding, and they have pictures of it. And, but they don't have any sorts of DNA or any samples of it, but they know it's down there. They just can't classify it. So they're going to start using that eDNA.
Yes.
To do that. And then also that, that could go right along with, you know, proving that a Bigfoot does in classifying that a Bigfoot is actually a creature, through this DNA, new DNA process would be, you know, totally possible.
I think I've had the pleasure of speaking with Shelley Covington Montana, who's a big proponent of eDNA.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in regards to that. And I know it's one of those things that 10 years ago, it would sound like science fiction, Mike. And now we've got these contraptions that are being created and these machines that are able to pull things in. And they're obviously, they've tried using it over here in the search for the Loch Ness Monster,
right,
which ended up bringing up loads of very strange results, but sadly, nothing that would kind of lead us to believe that there's some kind of giant creature there. However, it did seem to say that there were a lot more eels than people were aware of there. So it is one of those things that when I've spoken to a lot of people in the modern sort of Bigfoot arena now, we seem to have really gone quite a lot further than I think people would have imagined 10, 15 years ago, that we used to just get people going out into the woods and just wandering around all night. Whereas now, we've got people like Shelley and Amy Boo and the people over in the Olympic projects and other people and such as yourself who are going out, trying different things, utilizing as many scientific tools as they can to kind of get us past this point of just footprints or just finding bits of hair here, there and everywhere. There seems to be a real sort of drive to kind of make it as impossible for this creature to stay as hidden as it has done so far.
That's a great way of putting it. And that's just thanks to the technology and the decreasing costs and availability to us Bigfoot researchers in the field that, that have that ability. Like, I would love to have a DNA lab, you know, where I could just send my samples to and, you know, they come back and be like, no, Mike, it's just a bear again. I would love to be able to do that, but unfortunately, that costs a lot of money. But we do have new technology. Like, I think the thing that's going to be you're going to see in the next year or two is the thermal drones. They're going to have a drastic impact on Bigfoot investigation and Bigfoot research, because you literally can't hide from them.
Yeah, I have seen those being utilized by Forest Gallant, and they are remarkable that they could. And that was like 4 or 5 years ago, Mike. So I can only imagine what the technology's gone as quickly as these things often do. They just seem to go from 0 to 100 in a very short span of time. So, and he was utilizing that. I think he was after the Formosan leopard, I think it was. And it was, they were able to use the thermal drones to prove that, because they simply couldn't keep up with it, obviously.
Sure.
But they could prove that there was a large creature there that had to be a leopard of some kind. It couldn't be anything else. And that was the first time I'd ever seen that on a documentary or a television program, that they were utilizing these drones. So they are remarkable.
Absolutely. And the cost of them too is, like I said, I can't afford one quite yet. It's getting down to the point where I might be able to in the near future. And the more people that utilize these types of technology, whether it be a thermal drone or regular thermal cameras or whatever type of technology you want to bring into Bigfooting, the more people that have it, the higher chance that we're going to get these more evidence and more of these not only fleeting pictures of Bigfoot on camera, but also the good pictures of Bigfoot that aren't fleeting. So it's just a matter of time, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think even if we just talk about normal drones, you look at how much they used to be 20 years ago.
And you
look now and you can get a fairly decent one for a couple of £100 these days. That can give you some amazing quality of film and battery life and things like that. So it is strange sometimes when we have these technological advances that something appears and it's £3,000, and then within 10 years you can probably buy five for that price.
Right, yeah. And I'm assuming, I'm not sure how much a pound is, but they sound about equal to dollars, I think, correct?
Yeah, they are at the minute, yeah. Sadly.
Yeah.
yeah, it's about a usually.
right.
It's a strange situation here in the UK at the minute. Usually it's about $1.33 to a pound.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. See, you learn something new every day.
So when you relocated, because obviously you moved up to New Jersey, mm-hmm. Were you sort of just thinking, because I think, did you move through work? Because you used to be an EMT, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I was doing EMT in Florida and I had some family situation, a family circumstance. So I had to move back up to Jersey. So it wasn't for work, but when I moved, I was like, oh man, my Bigfooting career is over. There's no Bigfoots in Jersey. and then I started doing some research and I was like, holy crap, New Jersey's like we have like, we're top five on the states. And that's incredible to me. And you know, my county, we have my county, Sussex County in New Jersey, Northwest New Jersey. We have the highest number of sightings east of the Mississippi, which is astonishing. And, you know, I think for the number of Bigfoot that we have in New Jersey, we also have the highest density of people in New Jersey. A lot of people, when they think about New Jersey, they think of like Newark and Patterson and Jersey City, which is all very urbanized industrial areas.
Mm.
But in fact, New Jersey's not like that. 70% of the state is like Greenland and it's a lot of forested regions. We actually have in New Jersey, the largest undeveloped tract of land between Maine and Florida.
Mm.
So people don't realize that that's the Pine Barrens.
Yes.
So, and that's obviously the Jersey Devil area down there.
Well, I think often, as you say, I think when people, especially most people outside of your immediate area in the northeastern part of the US are often very surprised when we speak about things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously Jersey, you've got New York and Vermont around you, but obviously on the western side, you are completely surrounded by Pennsylvania, which is an enormous state. And you've got so much lush greenness out there that it is one of those states that I think once people actually look into it and start to really have a look around the state and some of the beautiful natural formations and mm-hmm. forests that you guys have out there, it really does surprise people, because I think often people just presume if you're on the east or the west coast, everything's urbanized. There is no woods.
Right. I don't like Bigfooting in Pennsylvania because there's too much woods.
Yes.
It's hard for me to pin down a certain area to have a successful investigation.
Mm.
In New Jersey, it's a little bit easier because we have some greenways that we can work around. But and just the same thing with New York. I mean, New York is just phenomenal when it comes to Bigfooting. There's so many areas that a Bigfoot could be in. And like you said, Vermont and Pennsylvania. Then you even got, you know, West Virginia and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going down there this coming weekend. Actually, there's a Bigfoot conference down in West Virginia. So I'll be down there.
Ah.
I'm going to be doing some squatching while we're there as well. I'm filming an episode while we're down there.
Yeah. Well, you are. It is quite surprising. I mean, when you got back, and as you sort of jokingly referred to, that you thought you were moving to Jersey and that was the end of Bigfoot in your life, even I'm surprised. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I'm some kind of expert about each particular state, but I have to say, when I've been researching and reading about Bigfoot in the US, I have to say the state that always makes my eyebrows is Jersey, around your area, because it did really take me by surprise, primarily because I probably didn't know as much as I thought I did about the state, I have to say, Mike.
Sure. Yeah, but no, absolutely.
Along with York, Sussex County, I mean, I think Burlington is the next one. And between you, you've got such a long history of sightings in those particular two areas that it really does shock people when you dive into this subject and start to point out that Jersey's like probably the hot spot in the Northeast, isn't it?
You know, people raise their eyes when I say that at presentations too. When I go around, even in New Jersey, and I say this is where the Bigfoot are, people are like, "No way, they're not here." So I do a lot of research when it comes to Bigfoot in New Jersey, and especially in Sussex County, I have a database of sightings and stuff like that. But what's the shocking thing to me is that not only do we have the sightings and the history of sightings and the current sightings that we have, but you can predict. So
So in New Jersey, Bigfoot sightings increase by 80% every third year. So what does that mean? So take Sussex County, for example, where we're at right now. The Bigfoot are here in Sussex County. So I've had this year so far an 80% increase. I've had, I think, 11 reports of Bigfoot in Sussex County. I have not had any reports from anywhere else in the state. So in a year and a half from now, when they're in the complete opposite terminus, the opposite side of the state in the Pine Barrens in South Jersey, I'm going to be getting reports from down there, and I will not be getting any reports from up in Sussex County. So that's pretty, I think that's pretty neat when it comes down to, if you really look at the numbers, it's like, well, someone's not going to fake that, or someone's not going to hoax that.
Well, yeah, this is when I think it's one of those aspects of it that is a real bone of contention to me, because I think often there is this ridiculous notion that you've just got people faking everything.
Mm, sure.
And yet you have to consider that, well, if it's the same people that are doing it, they're having to go all over, even in New Jersey, they're having to go all over the state. But I know, as far as I'm aware, there are two or three counties in New Jersey that where there's been no real reports of it.
Yeah.
And I think when people fake stuff, they don't think about things like that. They just try and do it everywhere.
Mm.
And that alone would suggest that there's a lot more to this than meets the eye, because if you're going to fake it, you're not going to not know that Bigfoot hasn't been reported in certain counties. You're going to do it wherever you are. You might just take a trip down to the southeast of the county and try and drop some fake footprints around there or cause some problems.
Another perfect example is down in the Pine Barrens, I've found baby Bigfoot footprints and juvenile footprints. Nobody's going to fake a small Bigfoot. that's an oxymoron in itself. I don't think if you're going to go out, just like the Patterson-Gimlin film, if you're going to go out and hoax something, it's not going to be a female.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not going to be a small Bigfoot. It's going to be a big Bigfoot.
Mm. And we don't get many reports of smaller ones. I know I was recently speaking with Stan Gordon, and there was a tantalizing report, a very small report that he'd uncovered, where somebody was driving along and a tiny one just jumped on a car bonnet and bounced off and right. just ran off into the woods. And you don't really hear many reports of smaller ones. I know there are some alleged footage out there of people encountering them or seeing parents with the smaller Bigfoots and certain alleged film of one swinging about a tree, which was a very famous clip that was doing the rounds about 10 years ago.
We actually went up there and investigated that clip. You could check it out on our YouTube channel, the Catskill episode.
Yeah. And that's one of those where you think, but like you say, I think often they just presume it's like when they say, oh, well, it's just people running about in suit.
Right.
Well, if it is, why are people seeing female ones or smaller ones then? Have we got people dragging their kids out at 3 a.m?
Yeah, it's absurd. I mean, it is, when we're talking about Florida, it could happen. Florida, bro. I mean, wouldn't put it past anybody down there.
Look, yeah, we're dealing with a strange subject at the best of times. Nothing surprises me when we come to talk about certain subjects, Mike, I have to say. So how long was it until you'd sort of settled back into life in New Jersey, Mike, that you began to kind of realize that actually you dropped on by pure circumstance that you were in such a hot spot? And how long was it that you started to formulate a plan of where were you going to go first?
Yeah, it was instantly. I had, as soon as I moved back home, it was kind of a last minute thing. So I didn't get enough time to research and didn't really research New Jersey too much. But as soon as I got home and situated, I started looking, and I went on to the BFRO database, and I saw the number of reports, and then I'm like, okay, who can I talk to? And I was familiar. I used to be an investigator with the BFRO. So I hooked up with this gentleman. He's a good friend of mine named Eric Spinner. He kind of took me under his wing, and we started off that way. And then I instantly also created a Sussex County Bigfoot Facebook page to invite anybody that was interested in the county or had an experience, which I had come to find are plenty of people. To give them a spot to, open up and explain what they saw or, you know, read about other people's reports.
So is there, as with often, certain areas will have a hotspot or a place where you get a larger concentration of particular sightings coming through, Mike? What is the ground zero in Sussex County then? Where's the best place if you've got to go out for a visit for somebody who's not used to the state or is coming in from out of state, where would they go for a start?
Yeah, I think the best place to go looking for Bigfoot is probably High Point State Park. And that's no secret. It's the highest point in New Jersey for, you know, named that aptly for a reason. but it's also really good, a really squatchy area. We've gotten, in 2014, we found like 15.5-inch footprints there. And then more recently, we've gotten a vocalization that we sent off to a linguist, and it came back as no known animal and outside of human vocal range. So I think if you wanted to start looking for Bigfoot, not only in Sussex County, but in New Jersey, High Point State Park is the place to begin for sure.
Mm. So how long was it that it took you to kind of realize you'd got this seasonal spike in these reports? Because I've spoken to a couple of people previously about this. And when we dive into this kind of subject, if we're talking about a creature that has the ability to move about and show a semblance of intelligence, if we're led to believe many of the reports, Mike, then it would tend to suggest that these creatures move around into different areas and they follow their fauna, they follow their food sources, they have a cycle that they go around. And as we were saying about people probably not faking something like that, because that's taking things to too much detail, I think, for somebody who's just mucking about. So was that something that it took you sort of 3 or 4 years to kind of think, oh, there's a pattern developing here that it's not all the time?
Yeah, you know, I heard a professor, I think he was from Burlington County College or the College of New Jersey now, and he spoke a long time ago, and he opened my eyes to look for different sorts of patterns when it comes to Bigfoot. So I did. And you know, once you plot everything on a map and you see the true, not just the BFRO reports, but the actual all the reports that come in, because the BFRO database is not all the reports. There's, you know, other ones that aren't on the website, plus firsthand accounts and stuff like that. And once you really plot them on a map, it doesn't take much to come out with this, this 3 year kind of, every third year pattern. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said they follow the food source. I think they're nomadic. And I think they eat like what bear eat, and which would make sense because we have the highest density of black bear population in the Northeast, as well as Bigfoot sightings in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make sense that where the bear are, the Bigfoot are, and vice versa. So what's cool about the 3 year cycle is if you take a berry bush and strip it completely, it takes 3 years for that berry bush to grow berries again.
Mm.
Thus the third year cycle, in my opinion.
Animals have a fantastically sort of ingrained knowledge when it comes to things like that. I think it often astounds us that often we presume that animals don't have that intelligence, but it is remarkable how many creatures of all different types in the animal kingdom might have this sort of genetic coding that they seem to know these things from birth. It's almost as if they're born with this knowledge already installed into their brains.
Sure. Yeah. Look at the fish and the migration of the fish upstream. Like, that's totally against what animals normally do, but it's ingrained in those salmon to swim upstream.
Yeah. Sea turtles always baffle me, Mike, that they, once they're born, when the mother comes ashore to lay the eggs, that's the last time they'll ever be in contact with their mother. That's it. She goes off. Yeah. They never know. And yet, when they become adults, they know that they've got to come to shore to lay the eggs. So how did they know that? There isn't a book, as far as I'm aware, for turtles that they can buy, Mark. That's right. When you meet somebody you like and you mate, you have to go to this specific beach. It baffles me sometimes. I think it's just incredible. But how do they know these things? It's amazing that they've got this thing coded into them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Bigfoot, they have to have the same kind of thought process and the same coding that the other animals and even us as ancient humans, as Paleo Indians back in, you know, 10,000 BC as hunters and gatherers, we had the same ingrained thing in our head that we have to follow the food. Mm-hmm. And it just makes sense.
Are there any other trends that you've noticed? Because I know certain states will have pipelines running through them, Mike, which for some researchers seems to be a real magnet in the world of Bigfoot, that they tend to utilize these tracks because They're not very common. They're not the usual hiking trails. That it seems to have created a whole new sort of avenue for these creatures to get about. Is that something that you've noticed in New Jersey, or does that seem to just happen in other states?
I think it happens not only in New Jersey, but in all the other states. If you think about, especially you have the high tension wires, and you also have kind of newer gas lines that go in. And we have a gas line that runs through Sussex County, and a majority of the sightings, I'm not going to say every sighting, but a majority of the sightings are within a half mile of this gas line. And I think that they use it for a couple different reasons. One, I think if they're moving in a certain direction, it's going to be the easiest route of travel. It's not like you're going, it's kind of like as the crow flies, you're going in one direction and that's the direction that you're going to go. You're not going to go on some windy trail around like humans take.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you look at the food source, it's just grass and berries, and the amount of deer that are along these, you know, whenever in New Jersey, especially up here, whenever we come towards a power line crossing, we got to slow down because we know that there's going to be deer crossing the road right through there. So I think if Bigfoot has any sort of intelligence, which you obviously think that they do, they're going to be right along the inside of the forest line, looking at that food source. And I think they're definitely going to be using that gas line or that power line for movement and for food, 100%.
So how often do you go out investigating, Mike?
I try to get out once a week. I go camping. I try to go camping twice a month for like three nights at a time. So I get out a fairly decent amount. Of course, in the winter time, I don't camp below 40 when it gets to be 40 degrees out. I say that's no fun anymore. And unfortunately, I was just looking at the weather for this coming weekend in West Virginia, and it's going to be 34. So that's not good. I'm not excited about that one. But no, the winter is generally my downtime. What I do during the fall and the winter and early spring is I go around to different libraries and I do my my speaking tour. I do have a presentation that I take to different libraries, and I do that. I'm booking my Georgia tour, and I'm going to start booking my Tennessee tour for 2023, which is awesome. And then, you know, come this, once it gets a little bit nicer out, then we go back to, you know, going out camping three times a month or so.
Yeah. Are you surprised at how much you've embraced the outdoors? Because I know when I've heard you speak originally, you were just not somebody that did anything like that. Do you think one of the other aspects of Bigfoot, and I've heard this from other people, is that Bigfoot's only part of it? Because once you get outside and you start to appreciate hiking and the nature around you and going to some of these beautiful places all across North America, Mike, does it really just open your eyes up to a completely new world that you just didn't know existed, and Bigfoot's got you out there?
It's not about Bigfooting for me anymore. It's you know, Bigfooting is kind of like the icing on the cake for me. I'm able to go around to these areas and see these sites and stuff like you said, all because of Bigfooting. When they say, you know, when someone makes fun of me for Bigfooting, because it's inevitable, somebody always makes fun of you for liking Bigfoot, you know, and they're like, oh, that's so crazy. You know, that's so stupid. But I will say Bigfoot has changed my life in every aspect. I was an indoor kid in growing up in elementary school and high school, and my first time ever camping was this first Bigfoot experience that I had. And since then, I now don't like being inside. I don't play video games, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I long to be outside. Like I'm thinking right now how I'm gonna what I'm gonna be doing after this interview outside before it gets dark. But it's changed my life in such a pertinent way. And that's what I could, you know, by making the show the way that I make my show in an amateur kind of style, it's promoting, well, hopefully it's promoting young squatchers and squatchettes to get outside and do their own thing, whether it be Bigfooting or not. It doesn't really matter. It could be, photography. It could be, fishing. I'm into fishing now, you know, never thought I'd like that. you know, survivalist stuff. I could rub two sticks together and make a fire. Asked me 10 years ago if I could do that, I'd be like, you're absolutely, you need to go to the crazy person hospital if you think I can do that. But it's, and now, you know, this is what I do full time. I'm a full time Bigfoot researcher. And to be able to say that is insane to me. It just doesn't, it in all, if you look at it on paper, it shouldn't work. You know?
Yeah.
But for some reason, for somehow it is working right now, and I'm going to ride it until I can't anymore.
So obviously you like to go out a lot on your own, but I know you do group expeditions, Mike, when you go out with a team and you're going to look at certain specific areas. So how much planning goes into that? Because obviously I know you're one of those people who's very positive in regards to the safety of people going on trips, because I think often, once again, it's one of those situations that people really don't think about. But I often point out to people when we talk about North America, there are very large creatures running about in the woods at the dead of night. You've got to be very careful, regardless of what you're trying to look for, because you've got bears, you've got mountain lions, you've got all kinds of creatures wandering about. Even deer, if you catch the wrong one and startle one, it can give you a nasty knock if you're not lucky. So when you guys are sitting down and planning a mission, how long do you normally go out there for, and how long does it take you to kind of prepare and sort of lay the groundwork for any specific investigation you're going to go out?
That's a stellar question. I'm looking at the pile of papers I have right now, which go into, it's every expedition all the way up into April of 2023 that I have so far. And I'm looking at my one for this coming weekend, and it's about 60 pages thick. And that's just a normal expedition with a vending kind of thing on it. But safety is a big part of it. Like you said, when I go out, I'm more scared of, and this is the honest truth, ticks, spiders, and snakes. Those are the three things I don't like. It's not really bear. Mountain lions, those are things, they're animals of concern, but they're not the animals that are going to hurt you for the longest. Ticks, definitely. I actually was on an expedition in Michigan and I got a tick bite on a very unfortunate location.
Yes.
And I ended up with Rocky Mounted Spotted Fever.
Oh.
Which is like, I had 106 degree fever. I should have been in the hospital type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that scare me the most. So that's what I try to warn people about, especially we have a safety briefing before every expedition. And it goes over that kind of stuff. You know, what we have to watch out for. Poison ivy is another big one that always is overlooked. Especially walking in these power line areas, I'm highly allergic to poison ivy. So if it's in the wind, I'll get it. So I have to be very careful with that as well. And then obviously, you know, bug bites and stuff like that, you have to be worried for. But and planning the expedition, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that as well, is not just the safety aspect of it, but where you're going to go, where you're going to do the day hikes and the night hikes. And you have to also make sure if that's safe too. You're not going to do a night hike that's on unsafe terrain. So that's something that you need to scout out beforehand. It's you know, and this is all for just a private expedition with just a couple people. You know, this isn't for one of those big 60 people expeditions that we were talking about before. You can only imagine what goes into an expedition like that.
Yeah. So how long, when you're going out on an expedition, how long do you plan? And do you have a specific time scale that you are going to sort of settle down and just stay in a particular area when you're doing one?
Generally speaking, it's 3 nights, 4 days. That's the amount of time that a lot of people are comfortable with being out in the woods. I've been, you know, on 2-week-long expeditions, and I've been on 1-night expeditions, and, you know, I've had luck with both, you know, both. There's no right or wrong way really to investigate Bigfoot, but I think the longer that you stay in a certain area, especially if that area is a little active, then you're going to learn that area and learn how the Bigfoot react to different things. Like, are they vocal or are they more quiet? Do they like tree knocks, or do they come in and investigate you at night, or do they stay far away type of thing? And all you can learn all this through the longer time that you stay at a location, obviously. So the longer, the better.
Have you noticed specific areas have certain trends then when you're talking about the types of behavior you get?
Absolutely. Ohio, for example, has very aggressive Bigfoot. For some reason, those Bigfoot, they like to get close and intimidate you. Where in New Jersey, they're vocal. And they like their vocalizations in New Jersey, but they'll stay far away from you. So it's different. And that could be just the, not specifically the location, but that could also be the family group, if you will, and whatever personality that Bigfoot that we encountered has. That's not just necessarily a location generalization, more so of a population could be doing those things.
I mean, that's quite surprising for, once again, it's one of those things that I think we try to sort of prescribe personalities to the different types of Bigfoot across the US. And the usual grumpy ones or the more aggressive ones tend to be thought of as living in the southern states. And the northern ones are supposed to be friendly people of the woods, just kind of being nosy and curious. And yet, the more you read, the more you find out that that's a very dangerous presumption, Mike, to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, going into Ohio, I didn't realize that they threw rocks at you and they were that close up. So when I went to Salt Fork State Park and we filmed that episode, I was like, oh man, okay, that's new. That's something I'm not used to.
So when you go on an expedition, what's in your evidence collecting kit then? What do you usually look for? Are there any specific things that you are more keen to discover than other?
That's a good question too. I don't know. I like looking for tracks. I think finding tracks are my favorite. I know a lot of researchers like to look for hair and stuff like that. I think that's cool. I think that for me, it's just like finding that track is just like, oh man, that's like waking up on Christmas morning type of thing when you find something like that. But yeah, we have in our evidence collection, we have everything that you would need to get the gloves, tweezers, the bags, everything that you would have. Hydrocal, if we do come across a track, we got plenty of hydrocal. General stuff like that, and then we could always, you know, if we do find something that we don't have, we can always go get it, which is important as well.
Is that, once again, the more you do it, the more experience you get, the more situations you become aware of? Because I sometimes find it quite amusing that I will see videos on YouTube or from the old days where you just basically get people wandering around the woods just picking stuff up with their hands and putting it in their pocket. And you're like, sure. I'm not sure there's going to be much evidence on that. That's not you now.
Yeah, no, well, no, and but that I think depends on the amount of knowledge base, I guess, if you will, that you would have with how to preserve evidence and stuff. Like I didn't know too much about, like, for example, you're not supposed to put stuff in a Ziploc bag, like hair and stuff. You're supposed to put it in a paper bag. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff you wouldn't know unless you had an in the industry, if you will. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, like you said, it does take time for you to learn these things. And I can't tell you how many times I've ruined casts. They've broken because the mixture was totally not correct. But it just takes time and practice. And the more you practice, the better that you get at it. Just like anything, really.
I mean, I've always been very impressed with you that you're one of those people that doesn't seem to keep things as a secret, like these little tips, Mike, as we're talking about there, about putting hair in a paper bag rather than a plastic bag. Because often, as with any kind of investigation into the weird or the Fortean, there will always seem to be people who are gatekeepers who won't share these little tips that for the people that are really interested in it. And like you say, it can be really daunting, especially in the world of Bigfooting, because I think there are so many characters at the top level that often people can be intimidated, not through their behavior, but also the fact that when people are so well known in a certain field, people feel as though they have to do exactly as that particular person does without really knowing why that person does it.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong way to Bigfoot. Just like you were saying just a second ago, is we don't, as Bigfoot researchers, we are probably the worst people at reporting evidence. it's true, because for as researchers, if we all had a database that we put all of our evidence in all the time and everything, and everybody else had that access to that, we would be on a different level right now. I don't think there would be a question if there is a Bigfoot. The fact that for some reason we decide to secretify all of our research areas and all the evidence that we come across. I was talking to a researcher the other day at an expo, and he showed me this audio file of a Bigfoot howl. It was the best thing I've ever heard before, like better than some of the best things. And I'm like, oh my God, who are you going to send it to? He's like, nobody. So it's like, you know, and it's true though. It's like, you know, you get the evidence for you, but I don't know. It's if everybody seemed to work there or did work together, or if there was a way that we could all work together without the politics and the egos getting in the way, I think we'd be a lot closer to finding Bigfoot than we are right now.
Yeah. I think there's been so many issues over the years, and I think this goes back to the Four Horsemen era, Mark, that I think that there are certain people that they want to be the one. Doesn't matter how they get that proof. They want to be the one, and everybody else can go to hell as far as they're concerned. And that's, I don't think that's a modern problem. I think that's something that's probably been in the world of Bigfoot for, what, 60 odd years since it's become a cultural phenomenon, really, Mike. And I think there are a lot of people that are sort of pulling together, but I am also aware in recent years of specific investigators that have been taken to specific areas that are supposed to be a secret. And then they've suddenly decided that that's their area and they're going to charge people to come with them into it.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of my big things, and I can't knock it because it's how I got into it, but you shouldn't have to pay, especially on your very first time, you shouldn't have to pay money to go look for Bigfoot.
Hmm.
I think you pay money, if you want to pay the money, you pay money to network. And yeah. I think that's a very good way to network. But I think just looking for Bigfoot, you shouldn't, everybody can, that's one thing I learned very quickly when I first got into Bigfooting is I could do this by myself.
Yeah.
You know, this is pretty simple. It's, there's not much to this. But again, it's, you know, you needed to get to that point initially, obviously, to have the wherewithal to know what to do and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think it's just having the confidence to actually strike out on your own and not be worried that you're doing everything wrong, I think, more than anything, isn't it, Mark?
Oh, well, I'll tell you, my I think it was my second or third time out, I was doing everything wrong. like we were in Colt Creek State Park in Florida, me and my buddy Jimmy, and we were doing Bigfoot. I was doing a Bigfoot howl every 2 minutes. Like everything with a brain knew that there were two idiots in the woods running through the woods, making these vocalizations, and they should have got out of there. Right. But lo and behold, we got a little bit later, just walking through the woods, we got two sets of eyes reflecting back at us. One was like a fire red color and the other was like an aqua blue color. And what's that? You know, we thought we were so new at this. We thought people had eye shine. So we were like, we thought they were people, but, looking back at it, there's not much that could have been besides a Bigfoot or two Bigfoot, actually.
Have you ever come across that kind of scenario before or had a witness come forward with that kind of thing? Because that in itself seems quite a unique experience, because often the presumption is that when we hear people who see eye shine in the woods or late at night on the edge of a road as they're driving through, they will usually, I would suggest, Mike, 90% of the time, say that they're seeing something with red eyes.
Right. Yeah. I've gotten all sorts of different reports of colors. Blue, yellow is very common up in New Jersey. Red, obviously. What's really interesting about that is species of the animals, members of the same species, have the same color eye shine. So why is there so many different colors when it comes to Bigfoot? That's something that doesn't make sense to me.
That's a very good point, actually. Yeah.
So I don't know what the answer to that is.
another mystery piled on top of everything else that we have to do with, Mike. Have you ever had these kind of, my favorite type of witness accounts, Mike, are usually hunters or people that go out all the time into the woods and the forests of North America. And they've been doing it for years. And then they have an experience one day that completely changes their life. And it either sends them, I've found when I've heard these people speak, often they are very emotional when they're discussing about what happened to them and how it made them feel. They either hang up their guns and say, right, I'm never going into the woods again.
Mm-hmm.
Or they suddenly become really pro Bigfoot, as in regards to that they feel that they need to learn more because they want to protect these creatures. It's changed their life in a way that they didn't think.
And in not one circumstance have I heard a hunter say that once he's seen one in the woods, that he wants to go and actively hunt one.
Yeah.
That's never the case, which I think is remarkable, is coming from hunters, you know, who are designed to go out and let's shoot things. For them to say that, no, it's too human-like for me to shoot, that said something in itself. I mean, that's not just a localized account. That comes from all over, where they say that the Bigfoot is too human-like. And to me, that's fascinating because of all the people that would know what's in the woods, hunters would know what's in their crosshairs.
Mm. Yeah.
And the fact that they don't is shocking, really. It's a little uneasy.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think for me, I always give those reports more credence than anything else, as you say, because these are people whose livelihood depends on the fact that they can actually tell what an animal is. And sure. I think when people go, oh no, they've probably misidentified a bear or an owl or something. And you just think, well, if he's been doing it for 30, 40 years and he's got quite good at it, I'm pretty sure that that person's going to know what a bear looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the major questions that I get every time I do a presentation, where are the bones? Right. And I'm sure you've been asked that a million times and, you know, and I won't get into it, but it just, I have a black bear skull, right. It was roadkill that I got from a friend in North Carolina. But I ask hunters, you know, who come up to me and say, oh yeah, well, where are the bones? And I say, well, you've been hunting in the woods for 40 years. How many black bear skeletons have you come across? And every single one of them gets this shocking kind of like, I'm an alien with three heads. and they say never. And it never fails. I never once have I had a hunter come up and say, oh yeah, I just came across a black bear skull.
Mm.
So then I come and then I say, well, you know, you have the limited population, yada, 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 the Bigfoots and they're smart and blah, 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 blah. But I think that's cool that, you know, you bring up the black bear and how hunters can misidentify them. But it's obviously not a misidentification, especially somebody that hunts bears, you know, or from a hunter that hunts bears, they know what a bear is.
Absolutely. And especially the ones that have these experiences over winter, which is another thing that often gets thrown out, that people say, oh, well, it's a bear. And you're like, what, in January? Are you sure you know what bears do over winter?
Well, actually, it's called toper. There's a fun fact for you. In North America, bears don't actually hibernate.
Mm.
It's called a toper, I believe it is, where they're in a kind of limited hibernation.
Yeah.
Where they're still active and they still get up and they still move around. You don't get into hibernation until you get into like the really cold, like northern, like Arctic region of Canada.
Yeah.
So it's a fun little side fact.
Yeah. But they tend to just kind of not go as far as they normally do, don't they? They tend to stay around their den and just, they don't sort of explore as much as they would do in the sort of spring, summertime.
Very lazy, extremely lazy. If you were to see a bear roaming around in the winter, it would be unusual. But yeah, it's not to say that they don't go to sleep for X amount of months.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, humans tend to do that over the winter as well. We all get very lazy and don't tend to wander very far. We might go to the shop and then just come back inside and try to keep as warm as possible, Mike.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm gearing up for. I got my winter clothes down today.
So have you got a favorite state outside of New Jersey then, Mike, that you've loved to go to? Because I think, have you been to about 15 different states so far on your expedition?
Yeah, I think 18. We've been to last count. You know, I like going to Florida just because that's kind of where I got my start.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that's in Florida, you know, the Ocala National Forest, because if you want to look for Bigfoot, that is the hot spot in Florida. I was just up in New York State and Vermont State this last weekend, and I'll tell you, it's just so gorgeous out there.
Mm.
You have the green mountains and stuff. It's a hard question to answer because it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for Bigfoot, I would go to Whitehall, New York.
Yes.
If I picked one spot that I've been to, I would go to Whitehall, New York. And that's just because it's produced evidence every time that I've been there.
Mm.
If I want to go somewhere for the views, I would go probably to the Adirondack Mountains or the Great Smoky Mountains.
Yeah.
You know, it just depends on what you're looking for. Waterfalls, you know, totally different. But everybody gets into Bigfoot for a different reason. So I know, like, for example, I had a buddy He actually just passed on, which is really unfortunate, but he was really into Bigfooting, and he wasn't into the sightseeing and stuff like that I am. So he would say Whitehall, New York is a place to be because that's where the Bigfoot are. But for me, I like kind of like a generalized everything. I was in Kentucky. Kentucky's beautiful too.
Yeah.
And I can't pick somewhere.
That's a very good answer. So have you been fortunate enough to kind of, because I think if I was based in the US, I would be trying to sort of go to the most famous locations. And obviously, as you've mentioned there, Whitehall is synonymous with Bigfoot in New York. The Beast of Whitehall is a very well recorded and attested case, and there's been documentaries and books galore about that particular area over the years. And I know New York Bigfoot Society, they do a lot of stuff out there around Whitehall, as you say, because it seems to be a real hotspot that consistently gives people experiences. Have you had the opportunity or the fortune to travel to any other famous locations where there's been these great reports?
No, you know, not that I can think of. Trying to think of any famous. There's. It depends on really the locality that you go to. I know in like the Allegheny region of Pennsylvania, there's been the Jacobs photo.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to that location, which is cool. In Vermont, they have the Vermont Baby Bigfoot photo.
Yeah.
Which I was just there this past week, and it's right next to Whitehall, actually. And we were camping and doing a little investigation on this property. But, you know, synonymous where I would like to go up into the, you know, into Alaska and to go up there. Or I know in, you know, in the Northern Cascade regions in Washington State and Oregon, I mean, I would love to get up there. Those are kind of the hot spots, if you will, that everybody thinks about Northern California. I would love to go to Bluff Creek.
Mm.
That would be very cool. And I think I will do that when I get out there. But it's just, you know, the funds of getting out there, unfortunately.
Yeah, very much so. Obviously, as you were referring to earlier, you're planning your expeditions for next year. So what states have you got lined up for the start of 2023 and going on further into the summer then, Mike?
Yeah, we're going to start our year off in Florida again. We're going to, we're speaking at a bunch of different libraries down there, and we're going to actually a couple new areas that I've never been to in Florida, which is going to be really cool. Then we're going March, we're going to start our Georgia tour. I've never been squatching in Georgia before, so we're going to be down there. And then in April, we'll be in Tennessee, in the Eastern Tennessee region, the Smoky Mountain area, looking for Bigfoot and doing some presentations there. So that's just the beginning of 2023 that I got going so far. And then, of course, throughout the summer, there's going to be some really awesome expeditions that we don't know where to yet.
Yeah, just going to see how you feel.
Yeah, see how I feel and see where I want to go.
So obviously you've got this conference coming up in West Virginia. So have you done a few conferences before? I know obviously you were referring to doing some library talks and things like that, which I think for a lot of researchers in a variety of topics these days, Mike, tends to be a really good sort of way into the general public these days, which I'm always surprised when I speak to authors and investigators across primarily the north of the states, that a lot of local libraries tend to do these talks that seems to be really popular with families and kids.
And not just families and kids, but everybody. And I was speaking with, I did a presentation last week, and I was speaking with the director of the library, and she was like, I cannot believe the age range of and the diversity of the people that came. And it's true, because everybody who hasn't thought about Bigfoot, you know, everybody's thought about Bigfoot at least once in their life. And that's kind of how I lead off trying to book these library presentations is, you know, it's not about whether something exists or it doesn't exist. It's about opening your mind to the possibility. One of my favorite quotes is, life with the possibility of Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster is far superior to one without.
Mm.
And I try to say that. I say that at every presentation, and it means a lot. You know, if you really break it down, that means a lot.
Yeah, it did. And I think often there is this perception for a lot of people when they're looking at these subjects from the outside in, that I think for a lot of people, they just think that this is down to people needing to believe in something, Mike. But when you start to speak with people, and I would imagine when you do these talks at libraries and public outlets, that you'll get people hanging around, waiting until people have drifted away, and then they'll come forwards and say, Can I tell you about what happened to me? Do you find that's probably one of the best ways of getting a face-to-face report from somebody?
I'd say that happens, I would say, average about once a presentation. So yes, that's a great way to get reports. Another way that I've found is I decked out my car in Bigfoot graphics. Mm-hmm. So my vehicle is a Bigfoot mobile command center.
Yeah.
And it's bright, reflective, in your face. It says research real big on it. And I just go to 7-Eleven and I'll get reports. Like that's one of the best ways to just drive around town and park somewhere and people come up to you and start talking about Bigfoot. When I get gas, that's the biggest thing is the gas station attendants will come up and some of them are a little crazy. I'm not going to lie, but I think that's one of the really just best ways of researching Bigfoot is by getting these reports that nobody has ever told anybody before. They have nothing to gain from it, nothing to, you know, not looking for any fame. And it's those reports that are the ones that really hold a lot of weight with me.
Mm. Do you think that one of the other problems that we have when we're trying to collate just how many reports and experiences are out there, as you referred to earlier when we're talking about BFRO website, a lot of people presume, Mike, that that's the be all and end all when it comes to reports. Mm. And yet there's probably, I don't know, half a dozen different sites out there that have catalogs. Do you think sometimes that one of the biggest problems, as we were saying earlier about the cross-pollination of information or the lack of people sharing info, when we look at everybody and all the reports on all the different end indexes, there's probably a lot more than people presume, because now I think is that BRFO we've got something like between 3,000 and 4,000.
I think what I would challenge every investigator, because I know you have a lot of investigators that listen to your show, is make a database like I did. Is you can go online if you go to Facebook and go to the Sussex County Bigfoot page, you can click on, you go to Google Maps and you can click on every data point of every sighting in the county. There's 58 of them. And you could read everything from the initial report to the final investigation, you know, end investigation report of what happened. And that's combined from all of these different sites, plus the word of mouth that I get. So if that's, you know, openly accessible to everybody, the locations of the reports are not a secret. It's all available. And I would challenge anybody else who is looking to look for patterns and to learn more about this creature, to do the same and try to find these patterns that I've been able to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. I think as well, it's imperative when you are speaking with these people, Mike, have you had because I love these situations where you'll have somebody at one of your presentations who might be 70 years old and they'll say, yeah, this happened to me 50 years ago. Do you still get these really old reports when people come forwards? Because I think often when you talk about presentations and people coming forward, they just presume it's somebody who's had something happen to them in the last 2 or 3 years. But I would imagine in your experience, and I know this has happened for other investigators, that people have come forward and said, I've never told anybody about this and I'm in my 60s. And this happened when I was 14.
Mm. Yeah. Perfect example is I was, this wasn't at a presentation, but more so my vehicle. We were talking about my vehicle and, I was at this establishment and, somebody was, his grandfather was like, the guy said, my grandfather's got a couple Bigfoot casts, that he's never shown anybody. You want to talk to him? I said, sure. You know, of course. And I got talking to him a couple of weeks later. I ended up going to his house and he showed me 70 Bigfoot casts.
How many?
Taken 70 that he's taken from the bottom of this Kittatinny mountain range in Sussex County that he's never showed anybody before. And that kind of stuff is just crazy. You have to wonder how many other people have this kind of stuff.
Good Lord. Was it just that he didn't want people to know that he believed in Bigfoot, or did he just think nobody would believe him, Mike?
Well, he didn't want people to think he was crazy. And, you know, a lot of people up here don't talk about the whole Bigfoot thing. It's only been in the past, I don't know, 10 years or so that Bigfoot has been kind of
rejuvenated in the county, and people are like looking to talk about it and looking to go to these presentations. Like most of my presentations, especially up in North Jersey, they're, you know, standing room only.
Mm.
So it's not that people aren't interested in the topic. I think it's a rejuvenated interest. I think it's, especially after COVID, people are trying to get out now. And when they get out, you know, and they go into the woods, maybe doing something they've never done before, that obviously brings a sense of mystery into it. And it's just this exceptional topic that, you know, anybody can gain from having Bigfoot in their lives, whether it be just telling a story to your kids about, you know, the keeper of the forest and don't disrupt the forest or Bigfoot will come get you type of thing, or the booger will come get you. Or to the seasoned researcher who's really trying to, who's spending thousands of dollars worth of equipment trying to, with no income back from it, trying to find out what this creature truly is. And to me, that's pretty incredible. I don't think you can really gain that from many other topics.
Yeah. I find that staggering that gentleman has collected such a body of evidence, because I think outside of the professional world of Bigfoot, Mike, I doubt there are many people that have got that many casts.
Well, you don't know. And that's the thing. He's never told anybody. So, and if it wasn't for my vehicle and being in the right spot at the right time with his grandson being there, he would have never told anybody until he passed on. And guess what? He would have never told anybody his entire life.
And like you say, there could be hundreds of people like that all across the states. And how many people have gone to empty a relative who's passed on's garage or their attic and found all these plaster casts and just chucked them in the trash?
Yeah. And say, what is this? Well, and it's not only that, is what about the people that don't report their Bigfoot sighting? Not even like finding tracks and stuff, but just have a perfect Class A experience, and just you're like, no, I'm not going to report to anybody.
Yeah,
just because they don't want to, or because it's an inconvenience, or whatever have you. You know, how many people have had that experience as well?
Or try and rationalize it and talk themselves out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Remarkable. So, what's next for you, Mike? What, other than you've got these trips planning up, what's next for you and your channel, and where do you want to take it next, my friend?
Yeah, we're gaining, our channel's growing. Everything seems to be growing. We have a new Etsy thing. I'm trying to do as much as I can full time now with this Bigfoot thing. So we do go around to a lot of conferences, but we also have our Etsy channel that we sell. We got like Christmas ornaments, Bigfoot Christmas ornaments and magnets and stuff. So I'm going to keep doing that and, you know, see where it takes me. We actually have, my next thing is, my next big project, I guess, of next year is going to be the Mantis Man. We actually have a 6 foot tall grasshopper praying mantis thing that lives in a watershed in North Jersey, the Musconetcong River watershed. And it's been seen for a couple of years, and I'm going to go try to find it. It's horrifying. That I think that's more horrifying than coming across a Bigfoot.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've seen a couple of reports from people. I remember seeing one guy, I think he was fishing with his brother or his best friend somewhere. I'm not sure where it was. He was in the north of the US. Mm-hmm. And he turned around and across the riverbank, he saw a giant mantis figure looking at him, which is one of those things that when we're dealing with the remarkable and the incredible, we're talking about Bigfoot and the possibility that there's 8 foot bipedal hominids wandering around North America. I think when you start to delve into aspects like that, you just think, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah. And the chance that it exists is slim to none. And I'm going into that, realizing that, I mean, biologically, this can't happen. I mean, first of all, praying mantises don't even like water.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're seen in the river doesn't make any sense. But, I think that the legend behind it, and it's a story that a lot of people, I think, would, kind of enjoy reading about and listening to and seeing.
Mm.
And I think that's what it comes down to is not necessarily trying to look for something that doesn't exist, but, you know, making it fun and doing something that you truly like to do.
Has this given you an appetite to go monster hunting anywhere else outside of the US, or is there any particular other legendary cryptid that you've really got into? Because I would imagine, with the greatest respect, Mike, 15 years ago, you'd got no idea about most of these things outside of the US.
Yeah, no, nothing. You know, I'm stuck on Bigfoot. Like I said, the Mantis Man, kind of that seems cool to me.
I would love, it would be a dream of mine to go down to Tasmania to research the Tasmanian tiger. That would be the thylacine. That would be such an experience. I would love to do something like that. And the work that's been going on down there and stuff, I follow it pretty closely. It's just a ridiculously amazing. I would love to be part of it.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes down to it is, I think it was Bigfoot that threw those rocks at me. And that's kind of what I've been sticking with. And that's kind of what I want to find out is, you know, what is that? What is the Bigfoot thing? Mm-hmm. And then maybe, you know, like we were talking about before, maybe if and when I do find a Bigfoot, maybe I can look at other types of cryptids like the dog man or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you ever get bored, you can just nip to the Pine Barrens. You never know what you might find in there going on legend.
Pine Barrens are creepy. Yeah. The Pine Barrens are a creepy area. You could find a lot of different things in the Pine Barrens that you would probably not be able to find most other places in the world.
Yeah. It's another remarkable part of geology in the North American area. It's a stunningly beautiful, but also quite haunting area, isn't it?
Mm. Another fun fact for you, the Pine Barrens have the cleanest drinking water on the earth. Actually, it's the cleanest aquifer in the earth is behind and underneath New Jersey. Go figure. Yeah.
No comment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something's. Yeah. That's incredible. Amazing. Well, Mike, it's been a real pleasure to finally get a chance to speak with you. Where can everybody follow your work, find your channels, and keep up to date with everything that you've got going on, my friend?
So we have a new website, actually. It's shadowofredeye.com. You can find all of our stuff on there. We're also big on Facebook, In the Shadow of Big Red Eye. Our YouTube channel is where our bread and butter of everything go. That's Sussex County Bigfoot is the name of the channel. And we're also on Instagram at Shadow of Red Eye.
Brilliant. I'll put links to everything in the show notes as always.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining me. I mean, your YouTube channel alone, I think you've got well over 100 clips and videos on there now.
So oh, yeah.
There's something for everybody. And you've been all over the place. And as you say, you show it bare bones and everything. So it's clearly a passion and a love that you've been bitten by. And all power to you, Mike. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you. And I hope we get the chance to speak again in future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.